From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Science can both fascinate and frighten us. And today we'll talk about a NASA-sponsored project that gets college students involved in climate change research. Then we'll unpack a new study that reveals how often doctors and hospitals make deadly mistakes. That's coming up. First, though, I hope you had a lot of good food over the holiday weekend. Biscuits have been on our mind and your mind since last week. We paid a visit to the Biscuit Triangle. That's what food writer Brad Kaplan calls the stretch between Marietta and Kennesaw, where you can find some of the most delicious biscuits in Georgia. And we asked where you go to get your biscuit fix. Here are your first thoughts.
My name's Kaz Cole. I'm from Dalton, Georgia. And the best biscuits in the state of Georgia are from the Cremo Drive-In here in Dalton, Georgia, the carpet capital of the world. Sounds like there's something else. If you haven't had them before, you need to try them.
And a listener who goes by Santos on Twitter heard the segment, paid a visit to the Ugly Biscuit in Kennesaw. Santos, we're waiting for your report on how that trip went. We also asked about your hangover cure suggestions during the break room Friday. Many of you perhaps need some advice after a long weekend. Wesley Tharp tweets, can of ginger ale, then V8 with two aspirin. What friends tell me anyways. Sam Burnham tweets, mostly water, quality drinks, and more water. And Neil Cassidy tweeted us a photo of a really big Bloody Mary. So we assume he believes in the hair of the dog theory, which is that the only way to cure a hangover is by ingesting more alcohol. We love to get your ideas and suggestions. You can call us at 404-500-9457. Then we're on Twitter at OSD Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Heart disease and cancer are the top two killers in this country, but the third leading cause of death in the U.S. might surprise you. It's medical errors. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine made this discovery recently. The study team was led by Marty McCary, and he joins us now. Thanks so much for joining us, Marty.
Great to be with you, Celeste.
Also with us is Emory University medical ethicist John Banja. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Marty, what is a medical error? What does that include?
Well, it includes preventable complications, patients falling through the cracks in the system, and unnecessary treatments, things that happen that shouldn't happen, or collectively we refer to it as medical care gone wrong.
I want to play, John, a comment from Jerry Giannoli. He's a surgeon in Louisiana and a member of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. He says the data in this report doesn't add up for him.
In order to get to that quarter million number they're talking about, 35% of all hospital deaths would have to be due to medical errors, which just on the face of it sounds ridiculous. I mean, I've been around hospitals for 30 years, and I've sat on a lot of morbidity and mortality conferences, and I find that number just hard to believe.
What do you think, John? Is this number hard to believe?
No, not at all. I think the value of Dr. McCary's study is pointing out that the data that we have right now on error-related deaths only comes from acute care hospitals. When you factor in all the other visits that patients make to their primary care providers, to same-day surgery centers, to rehabilitation hospitals, where error-related deaths could also occur, I could easily see that number going up, 200, 300, 1,000. The fact of the matter is, though, that these numbers are really predicated, and they've been developed by statisticians and epidemiologists, and these folks should know what they're doing and what they're talking about.
And yet, let me play for you, Marty, another comment from the same physician, Jerry Giannoli, of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, and he says fewer people are dying in hospitals.
That's in spite of the number of admissions have gone up, the age of the patients have gone up, and the complexity of the medical problems the patients have has gone up. So if anything, the problem is getting better, not getting worse.
He points to data from the CDC that shows hospital deaths inpatient dropped by 10% between 20 and 2010. How am I to understand all the differing data?
Well, I think there's opinion and there's science. And as a practicing surgeon, I certainly have no trouble accepting what the data show. And the data show clearly that up to 10% of all deaths in the United States are preventable in the short term. That is, are due to preventable complications, patients falling through the cracks, and unnecessary treatments. And you know, Celeste, almost everyone in America has a story. They have a loved one, they have a friend, they have someone that was harmed. You know, we did not do original research on medical errors. Instead, what we did is we did an analysis of the best existing data out there from the New England Journal of Medicine and Health Affairs and all the best medical science journals. And it was clear to us that public health has sort of matured in isolation of the medical science on medical error. And the number that we've been citing in healthcare, by the way, for which there's 100% consensus, is that about 100,000 people die a year from medical error. That number's been out there since 1999 from a famous Institute of Medicine report. It is the most highly cited report in all of the entire medical literature on quality and safety. Well, that number's based on a 1984 study, in part. We've been citing that number.
Which, by the way,
was not a very good study. And we've been citing that number that 100,000 people die a year from medical error for decades as if it hasn't changed. Well, all we did was update that number based on the best available science in the medical literature. And what we found is that the most conservative estimate was about 200,000. Our point estimate was 250,000, and the range was 200 to 400,000. Anywhere in that range places the problem of medical care gone wrong as the third leading cause of death, well above the currently listed number three cause of death, respiratory disease, on the CDC's list.
And we should remember, as you mentioned, this medical error includes undertreatment, overtreatment, errors in diagnoses, overdosing, also falling through the cracks, which sometimes happens because of issues with the insurance. And John, why is it worse in the United States than it is in other developed countries? What is it that we're not doing that they are, say, in Europe?
I don't know about that. I don't think we have good comparative data to show how we fare in comparison to Canada, the United Kingdom, and Europe. In fact, I believe there are some studies that might indicate that we deliver safer health care in the United States than occurs in other countries. The thing, though, that's really upsetting to me is the fact that our health care in the United States is the most expensive health care in the world. So here you have the most expensive health care system that nevertheless is witnessing error-related deaths constituting the third leading cause. So if these are truly errors, by the way, that these are truly error-related deaths that we're talking about, they should be preventable. And consequently, the question really is how come we're not doing better? By the way, I would like to make one comment about the previous physician who was saying that our discharges from hospitals, have a 10% decrease in the number of deaths. That may be the case. But if that patient is discharged home or to a nursing home and then dies 2 days later, a week later, a month later, from a medical error, I will guarantee you that that death will never be recorded as an error-related death. It'll be recorded as something else.
We did reach out to the CDC for a statement, since a lot of this research is based on CDC responses, and many of these numbers are excluded from the official health statistics. We didn't get a response to them. But ProPublica talked to Bob Anderson for their coverage of this issue. He's the chief of mortality statistics for the CDC, and he says complications from medical care are listed on death certificates, and codes do capture them. Although this is a suggestion, and let me go back once more to our physician, Jerry Giannoli, who says the suggestion is to add a box which would allow a physician to say that somebody died because of medical error. He doesn't think that's the right approach.
The recommendations that he made were that there should be a check spot on death certificates for if there is a medical error. Now, this is very misguided, mainly because death certificates are basically just a really good guess at why people died. And their correlation with autopsy findings is very poor.
So, Marty, how do we address the issue of what health statistics are excluded and how we keep better records?
Well, unfortunately, Celeste, this topic of medical errors has become very territorial. And as a practicing physician with a busy cancer surgery practice at Johns Hopkins, I can tell you that we need to change our approach to the problem. Unfortunately, there's this selective outrage that if we measure medical errors, we have to have every case documented with an autopsy. Well, guess what? We don't do that for the other causes of death listed in National Health Statistics by the CDC. When someone dies and we fill out a death certificate as a physician, medical examiner, or coroner, we list in our judgment what we believe to be the underlying and immediate causes of death. And that gets screened by the CDC, and they code what we write down. And they code based on billing codes. Why? Because in 1949, that's the only classification system they had. Well, people don't just die from bacteria and heart disease. They can also die from an overdose or a closed insurance network that results in fragmented care. We need to stop seeing this problem as a territorial, oh, doctors are bad or there's bad doctors out there. That's really not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a system that allows patients to fall through the crack. We're talking about system-level problems. And every doctor that I know, if you ask them, do you see care that's egregious, that shouldn't be happening, they'll say yes. If you ask them, is there a doctor in practice that you know of that should not be practicing, every doctor knows of somebody. We need to create a
safer system. Yeah, they won't go on the record, though. They're not going to go on the record and say that.
Well, these people that argue with the numbers, I say, why don't we just measure the problem like we do heart disease and cancer? I mean, as a cancer surgeon, we spend millions collecting cancer statistics every year. Why can't we measure the problem of medical care gone wrong?
Well, let's examine that, John, in the couple minutes that we have left. And part of the reason some doctors, as Marty alluded to, some doctors complain that they're worried about lawsuits and liability. What is the difference between a medical error and malpractice?
Well, the medical error has got to morph into harm, compensable harm, compensable damages. In fact, most errors that occur don't cause harms. And in fact, most bad things that happen to patients in hospitals are not the result of errors. So for a case to go to medical malpractice, you have to have an error that has caused considerable harm, harm that you can attach a dollar figure to, and then if you're on the plaintiff's side, hope that you're going to make a compelling case before the jury that, in fact, this compensable harm occurred. But, you know, going back just a step or two and really following up on Marty's remarks, it seems to me that there's no question that the 20th and the 21st centuries, we've evolved a rather dysfunctional reaction to errors. When a serious error occurs, we either run away from it, we deny it, we rationalize, we build a wall of silence around it. We don't want to talk to the harmed parties. We don't want to say I'm sorry or I apologize. I think that this has really been one of the major reasons why we've not made more progress since the Institute of Medicine's report came out in 1999 and presumably the patient safety movement began.
So we'll have really to end it there. Sadly, Emory University medical ethicist John Banja has lots to say about this because it's interesting. And Johns Hopkins University Professor of Medicine Marty McCary led this study into medical errors. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
This is On Second Thought. For the first time in more than 2 years, Atlanta rapper Gucci Mane spent a Memorial Day weekend as a free man. Gucci was released from prison last Thursday. He was convicted of firearm possession in 2013. Fans celebrated his return to the outside world. But followers can't really say they missed Gucci Mane while he was behind bars. That's because the rapper was extraordinarily productive as an inmate. He released new albums, a movie, and started writing an autobiography, all while incarcerated. We talked about Gucci Mane's creative drive on the show late last year. My guests were Atlanta hip-hop artist Mekonnen, who just released a song called Big Gucci in honor of Gucci Mane. And Regina Bradley also joined us. She's a hip-hop scholar and an assistant professor of African-American literature at Armstrong State University. She kicked our conversation off.
I still can't believe we're doing interviews about Gucci Mane on NPR.
I love that.
I I can't believe it either. Let's talk about that more. But I would imagine that there's a number of public radio listeners that have maybe never heard either of Gucci Mane or heard his music. So let's take a listen to probably his most well-known track, which is Icy. What to do, because we icy, so icy, we icy, so icy. All these girls excited. So, McConan, I think Regina is over there giggling because she can't believe we're playing that on public radio. But okay, so, Lynn, let's talk a little bit about this, because one of the reasons we're talking about Gucci Mane, besides the fact that he's been unbelievably prolific even while he's incarcerated, is the fact that so many people in Atlanta and in the South and throughout the country point to him as such an influence. And, McConan, you're one of those people, are you not?
Yes, I am.
What makes him so influential?
I guess because he represents for, like, a lot of people in the South. And I've just grew up in Atlanta knowing about him. But I know, like, his reach and his influence is all throughout the South. He keeps his relevancy from, like, staying connected with the times and supporting the new artists that are coming up rather than, you know, shunning them or trying to just ride their wave. He embraces them and, you know, like... He just gives everybody a chance, you know what I'm saying? He's, like, here not just for himself. So that's what a big thing is. That's why he's still, to be incarcerated, still has a huge influence and still is on the scene because he's for the scene and not just trying to be seen.
So, Regina, let me take this to you, because one of the reasons why people tend, who don't understand hip-hop, tend to dismiss it is because of they don't understand the lyrics. Often, and even with Gucci Mane, we're talking about music, which is talking about a drug culture. Often it's talking about the kind of culture people don't associate with so-called high-minded pursuits, right? Let me play you a little clip from Atlanta producer Zaytoven. He actually produced Icy, which was the beginning of a feud between Gucci Mane and Jeezy. But here he is in an interview with Vice talking about trap music and run-ins with the law and why this music seems to resonate even with people who aren't part of that lifestyle.
The trouble that they get in or try to stay out of is almost the reason why their music come across so good. You'll probably never live that lifestyle, never see it, but you feel what they're going through, feel what they're doing, because these are the type of lifestyle, you know, these guys are living.
So, Regina, help me understand how you put in context the kind of lyrics that are talking about, you know, wearing diamond chains and going out and partying and hanging out with lots of women. How do you make that part of literature?
So I want to slightly back it up, because when you were playing Icy, I was dancing in my seat because it took me back to my college undergrad days at Albany State. but I really find it interesting, because normally when you think about trap music, you don't necessarily think about party music. And for me, that's one of the reasons that Gucci Mane is so influential, is that he's bridging these genres in Southern hip hop together to create kind of a new sound, a new space. But in terms of, you know, why it's significant in lyricism, I do want to state that, especially in the South, is that lyricism is important, but it's not the be-all, end-all. I often say that we listen for the beat first, and if we can nod our head to it, then we actually pay attention to what's being said. So I think it's really important to kind of establish that. But anyway, Gucci's important because when Zaytoven was talking about the feeling of it, again, that goes to the way it sounds, the way it feels. And the better that it sounds coming from the knock in the trunk, the more that we're going to pay attention to it and listen. But I think that the reason that a lot of folks are so dismissive of Gucci Mane and a lot of Southern hip-hop artists in general is that we don't understand that their perspective doesn't necessarily hold up what's considered, you know, a bi-coastal or Northeast and West Coast genre, because of the fact that what we're pulling from is so specific to our experiences in the South. And I think that one thing that people have to understand is that literature is not just what you find in a book. Literature is any type of text that delivers a message. And that's why hip-hop is so important, is because there's often multiple messages and multiple texts that are being delivered, whether it's through production, whether it's through lyricism, or even through visual, through music video. So I think that that's why hip-hop is connected to literature, is because it's a multimodal, multifaceted textual experience.
And I don't certainly don't want to give the impression that the only thing Gucci Mane writes about is partying or any of those other things. I want to play another example of that. This is a single off Gucci Mane's The State versus Radrick Davis. This is kind of a more personal side of Gucci Mane. Let's take a listen. My best friend, and I'm my worst enemy, and no one else can hurt me unless I let them bitch a feeling me. And misery loves company, I have my share of misery. No mystery, my infamy got me in hip-hop history. So, McConan, what do we hear in Gucci Mane's music that makes him stand out? People refer to him a lot of times as sort of an innovator. What do they mean?
He's expressing real emotions and realness. You know, a lot of artists will make music for what they think others want to hear and, you know, trying to go after fake emotions. And so he's just expressing real emotions from his real self. And so that's why it comes off as... you know, people can relate to it and deal with it because it's not like he's trying to do this for having other people to feel him. He's just expressing himself from his real feelings, and other people can feel that. Other people can understand how someone can be their best friend and their own worst enemy. So,
well, let me play a recently released song, McConan, that you did in honor of Gucci Mane. This is called Big Gucci. Let's take a listen first. My still trapping hard, making plays in the South. Hey, and they can't wait till Big Gucci get out. I said my still trapping hard, making plays in the South. Hey, and they can't wait till Big Gucci get out. I assume you're talking about get out of jail.
Yeah.
So tell me, I mean, when you're honoring Gucci here, what are you honoring him for? When you think about him and your relationship with him, what's the most important aspect of your relationship with him?
We're honoring his hustle, his creativity, his genius to be independent and go for it. You know what I'm saying? You might not have the support of, I guess, the others that everybody's support they're looking from. It's just, you know, support yourself. And, like, when he was out, he was a staple in the music. Like, he kept people motivated with his music. He kept putting out content, doing shows, you know, supporting other artists, putting a lot of new artists on. Like, a lot of artists that have... came onto the scene over the last few years. Gucci Mane has had a big influence in supporting their career, from Future to Young Thug to, you know, a lot of acts coming out of Atlanta. And so, you know, my song is, you know, it's just about, you know, everybody in Atlanta still, you know, going hard, still hustling, still have that same drive and, you know, same determination. And they can't wait for, you know, Big Gucci to come out because, you know, he would be... honored to hear us out here going hard like this, rather than the scene sort of just dies and everybody just kind of, you know, fiddles away.
Well, there's a lot, Regina, in what McConan just said. I mean, we heard the words hustle and we heard the words independent especially, and I wanted to play this clip from Gucci Mane himself in which he's talking about kind of what motivates him.
I always been working to get to the point I am now, to continue to put out music. That was always my goal, and it still is my goal, to get this point to do what I do now. Be a CEO, my own self, my own friends, my own family, and we make music and make millions of dollars. That's what I do it for.
I mean, Regina, we're talking about an artist who's been unbelievably prolific, just a massive number of... He's had solo albums on major labels. He's had solo albums that he released independently. He's had mixtapes, collaborative albums. That doesn't even include the number of guest appearances he's made. So I wonder how significant is it that he works independently as opposed to only releasing things through the major record labels?
Well, one, I mean, McConan already said it. It's that innovation, that hustle is real. Being able to articulate himself and release, you know, his own type of product, which, again, is an extension of, you know, the trap. He's in the ultimate trap. I mean, he's in jail, and he's still being able to get us new music and get us new, you know, for lack of a better term, get us new product. And one of the reasons he's particularly important is we have to understand the way that hip-hop is consumed in this kind of contemporary moment, in this present moment, is that we have the internet, we have social media, we have these independent mediums that allow for us to be exposed to new artists, and also those artists who are able to take advantage of production-wise and release-wise what that means. And I really think that, you know, Gucci Mane more than anybody is reflective of what that kind of ambition means, especially in a social media moment. And again, kind of going back to McConan's track, I felt like that was something that I felt in my spirit. Like, I felt like I could really, like, put that in the car and ride. And that really reminded me of, you know, a previous era of trap that we really haven't seen mainstream-wise lately. And I always have this debate with my students. We always have this conversation about what trap is. And I had a student that told me that Katy Perry's, what is it, Dark Horse? Magic Horse?
Yeah, Dark Horse, I think.
Dark Horse was trap. And I about had a panic attack and a heart attack in front of the classroom because I was like, what exactly made it trap? And they were just talking literally about the way that it sounded. And I found that problematic, especially.
Well, let me stop you here then, because can you then give us your definition of what defines trap music? Because I'm about to ask you about how Gucci Mane changed trap music. So let's, I guess, define our terms first. What is trap, according to you?
Well, trap, according to me, is a subgenre of hip-hop that came out of Atlanta that demonstrated drug culture specific to an urban South. And, of course, sonically, you have the low synthesizers, you have the low bass or the beat. And for me, that's what I think about it, are those connections. So Jeezy and T.I. and Backbone and Pill and these folks who are speaking about these experiences, but it's not necessarily just lyricism, but also the sonic element of that as well, the way that it sounds.
Okay, so I'm going to take this to you, McConan, but let me play you this comment again. Let's go back to the hip-hop producer, Zaytoven. And he's speaking, again, in that interview with Vice about Gucci Mane and his sort of position as sort of a founder of trap. Let's take a listen.
We respect Gucci so much because Gucci will bring everybody together. He the mayor, like, he's the main guy when you talking about trap music. That's who you want to hear. So everybody else is, you know, understudies and doing their thing, but he just like the big dog. And he putting on everybody, he giving everybody a shot.
Yeah.
So, McConan, how do you think Gucci, you agree with that? You'd call him the mayor of trap music.
Yeah, or the godfather for me. You know, like, but he is giving everybody a shot. He gives the producers a shot. I mean, like, countless producers have made great careers from, you know, Gucci Mane giving them a shot, as well as artists and as well as video directors and, you know, just everybody who's in the arts and being creative. Like, he's somebody that come around and give you a shot, and you, next thing you know, your stuff is on television, and then you have other big labels calling to work with you and stuff, and it all started from the opportunity right there with him. But I wanted to say something about trap as well as my definition of it, what I think as well, and how Gucci Mane has changed it, is also with the amount of content that you put out. Like, it's always right. Work there. He's always giving you a new thing to work with, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, as far as being in the trap genre, I feel like to truly be in there and be recognized as well, as it's also banks on your amount of content and the amount of content that's not, you know, just not trash. So it's like, you know, he puts out a lot of content, and a lot of content gets used and played. So we can have like a 24 hours of Gucci Mane played in the club if, you know, somebody wanted to do it.
So then let me put this to you, Regina. You just told us what you think trap music is. So how did Gucci Mane change trap music? And has he kind of changed it permanently?
Oh, there's definitely a permanent change. Like, I'm not expecting to hear a Thug Motivation 101 or Trap House or trap music in 2015. Maybe because I'm a little older, and that was a different, you know, that was in my former life. But but yeah, I definitely think that he changed it as far as it being accessible to folks outside of the South and outside of Atlanta. And his music is dedicated to the Trap Boys, but not necessarily strictly for the Trap Boys. And I also think it's important when he started to kind of get that attention, because I know he's been doing records since around 2001. But I know that for me, I was first introduced to Gucci Mane for real with Trap House in 05. So with So Icy and everybody was playing it, and I'm like, well, who is this dude? But there's a particular trap sound that was in place. But the reason that he's so significant is because he's bridging these multiple Southern hip hop moments. So he's bridging crunk music, which is kind of like at its peak. He's also bridging trap music together and making it kind of like this, like the crunk trap, like party music. So, you know, on the same hand that he's talking about kind of dealing with those demons, his inner demons, and dealing with pushing weight and drug culture, he's also talking about having a good time. But I mean, like, kind of showing, like, you know, there's multiple facets of what you know, the trap and trapping means, and kind of introducing this to an audience that might not otherwise be familiar with what the trap is or what Southern hip hop is.
I wouldn't forgive myself, McConan, if I didn't ask you if you have any idea how he's able to remain so productive while still incarcerated, how he's pulling that off.
I feel like before he even went in, he was always working, you know, and putting in a lot of work. Like, he was a studio monster from what I've heard with the other producers before I came around and started working with those producers. But they said he was always working, doing like 30 songs a night. So a lot of those songs might be old songs. He might, you know, be recording through a Nokia phone. I don't know how he's doing it. He's a magician.
That is hip-hop artist McConan, also known as I Love McConan, and Regina Bradley, assistant professor of African-American literature at Armstrong State University. But my favorite title for you, Regina, is hip-hop scholar.
I'll take it.
thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Gucci Mane was released from prison last Thursday. This is On Second Thought. There is still a lot that we do not know about the effects of climate change on our world. NASA and the Air Force are teaming up to learn more of those facts, and they've called on a very special team of students from the University of Georgia for help. The team will build two small satellites to be launched into space. Caleb Adams is part of that project, and we heard from him a few months ago, actually, when he came on the show to discuss his fraternity-style house for hackers. He joins us by Skype from Portland, Oregon. Welcome back, Caleb.
Hello.
So they gave you guys competed for a grant. They gave you $200,000. Did that turn out to be enough to build this satellite?
So it's pretty much enough. The only issue is there are other things involved aside from just building the satellite that we have to account for, such as ground stations and clean rooms and such. And so that's not covered in the costs, but we are finding other ways to cover those costs as well.
How big? This is a cube satellite, and I assume that means it's shaped like a cube? Is that a fair assumption?
That is a fair assumption, yes.
Okay. How big is it?
The way I usually describe them is they're about the size of a Coke can. Ours, in particular, is a 3U CubeSat, so that's about the size of three Coke cans.
So it's a three, like if you turned smushed three Coke cans into a cube shape is what you're saying, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. It would be that long.
And that cost $200,000. I assume there's a lot of very advanced technology in it. So what was the biggest challenge in your design of this?
Well, the biggest challenge is definitely that we're undergraduate students and we're still learning how to do this. And that's part of the beauty of it. So we were selected by the NASA USIP, which is this Undergraduate Student Instrument Project. So NASA is allowing undergrads at different universities across the country to actually build their own spacecraft. And that's very cool, but definitely the most challenging part because we have to go through all the same design processes that actual NASA engineers or actual Air Force engineers would go through to build a spacecraft.
Now, this is the CubeSat Launch Initiative, and it's going to send these satellites into low Earth orbit. I'm told you're trying to watch patterns in vegetation and ocean waters. What data will a satellite collect?
Yeah, that is correct. It's going to collect vegetation health. It's going to look at the primary productivity and ocean productivity, and also look at near coastal sediment and other organic matter. And it's going to do this with a multispectral imager. So it's looking outside the range of the visible spectrum of light to tell how our coastal ecosystems are changing as climate change is affecting them more rapidly.
Is that in terms of trying to measure how high waters are rising along the coasts?
It can do that. It can also detect, maybe you can imagine that there is sediment runoff and other chemical runoffs from farms. It can look at the productivity of these farms and then detect where the runoff is going. It can detect how that's affecting ecosystems and so on and so forth.
My guest is University of Georgia student Caleb Adams. And if you have questions about climate change, it's a confusing topic in many time, at many stages along the development. And I know some people feel like scientific studies have been in disagreement at times. So if you are confused, what are your questions? You can tweet us now at OST Talk. Caleb, how do you respond to people's questions about climate change, especially when it comes to the impression some people still have that scientific opinion is divided?
Well, I guess the biggest thing is just to let people know that climate and weather aren't the same thing. So if, you know, it's supposed to be super hot, but it snows where you are, that's your local weather. That is not, that doesn't imply that the entire system is not warming overall. And it is. And each year after year, we've been having the warmest year after year for, I guess, the past 12 years now. I'm an engineer. I'm not a climate researcher. Yeah. So that's what they've told me.
Do you get the sense that NASA will actually use the data that you collect, or do you feel like this is more encouraging young students of science and engineering?
Oh, well, we're certainly going to use the data we collect at the University of Georgia as well. So this is data that we'll have available to all scientists and our own researchers at the University of Georgia. As a matter of fact, we started this CubeSat project by going to researchers at the University of Georgia and asking them, what's some useful information you would like? And they actually can use this data to help out a lot.
What did they answer? What was the data that they wanted?
Well, they decided that having a multispectral imager on our CubeSat would be able to look at shelf waters and salt marshes. As I mentioned, the runoffs.
Yeah.
But a lot of their research overlaps in that area. So that's what we decided on doing.
So you're part of the engineering, and I wonder, I mean, with something that small, to go through such an incredible experience in terms of passing through the atmosphere, how do you protect that little satellite?
Well, the satellite, when it goes through the atmosphere, is that going to burn up in the end? So initially, it actually is going to go up to the space station. So it's going to go up on a Falcon 9 or a Russian Soyuz or a Japanese.
It's going to get a ride on a taxi to the International Space Station.
That is correct. It is going a one-way taxi to the International Space Station, and then it's going to be shot off the side of the International Space Station, and then it's going to start performing science.
So you didn't have to design it to be able to withstand a trip through the atmosphere?
Not through the atmosphere, but it has to be able to withstand the stresses of the liftoff of the rocket. And it also has to be able to withstand the stresses of shooting off the International Space Station and other thermal stresses, because it gets very, very hot and very, very cold very, very rapidly in space. So we have to design it for those things instead.
And how much of a challenge was that to not only build it that durable and able to withstand those kind of pressures and temperature changes, but also include all of the very advanced technology in order to collect the data that you needed?
While it's so challenging, we're actually still working on it. So,
when is it expected to be done?
2018 is when it's expected. Yeah.
And how do you test it before you send it up?
We do a lot of simulations. As I mentioned, the kind of thermal properties. We do some thermal simulations in our lab. We're also working on building magnetic testing.
Wait. A thermal testing, that means you're putting it in the freezer and then sticking it in an oven?
Yes. We start with simulations.
Yeah.
And then we stick it in a freezer and we stick it in an oven. And we also stick it in a vacuum chamber. So there are a bunch of fun mad scientist things we get to do as undergrads. That's really great.
Yeah. It sounds more official when you say you're doing thermal testing, though, than I'm putting my satellite in an oven.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. I interrupted your flow. You were talking about how soon after you complete it, it might actually be shot out of the International Space Station.
Mm-hmm. Well, we expect that time will be shorter than the development period. So the development period is 2 years. So we have 2 years to complete the satellite, and then it will be sent to the space station, and then from there deployed, and then science begins. And we'll actually have a ground station at UGA that undergraduates are operating to communicate with the satellite, tell it what to do, and get the data back.
What year are you in school?
I am a senior, but I have one more year because I'm double majoring. So,
but it's 2016, and if you have another year, that means you start here and then finish next summer.
Mm-hmm.
So you
that is correct.
Will you'll be gone from the University of Georgia by the time the satellite's finished?
I personally don't know where I'm going to end up. I could go to grad school and finish up the project if I wanted. I could go to a NASA center and work if I wanted to try to go that route. Ames has a bunch of cool stuff going on there. But in general, this is an undergraduate project, and one of the things that me and my team are trying to do is structure it so that way undergrads can continue to have the same benefits that we've had and the same great learning experiences that we've had with the project. So I do think it's necessary to pass it on to other undergraduates.
Although you must be developing an emotional attachment to your little three Coke can satellite.
Oh, I definitely do.
Do you guys have a nickname for it?
Well, it's called Spock. We nickname it Dog Sat because it's like the university's satellite. Yeah,
DAWG Sat, right?
That is correct.
Yeah. Why do you call it Spock?
Well, that stands for Spectral Ocean Color Satellite.
So. Oh, that's way less exciting than just that you guys really like Star Trek.
I also really like Star Trek, so that's part of the reason.
So has this done, I mean, yes, you're going to collect great data, but I wonder if it has done what NASA probably hoped it would do, which would be to get the next generation of astronauts, astrophysicists, and engineers interested in space exploration. Has it accomplished that?
Well, I think it definitely is, because it's kind of having a runoff effect. NASA, when it gives out these grants, does a lot to add to kind of local economies and local intellectual institutions. And so we were funded by this, but because of that, we're able to have a lab for undergraduates where they can learn to make spacecraft, and that's going to continue on. We also have a large social media presence where we have podcasts and we interact with the public. We're going to start giving public talks about space at the University of Georgia. And so it very much does start kind of the process of getting people more interested in science and getting the public involved. And that's something that we like a lot as well.
As Caleb Adams, he is a student at the University of Georgia. Caleb, it's a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.
History professor Raymond Gavins passed away last week. Gavins was born in Atlanta and became a pioneer many times over. He was the first African-American to earn a PhD from the University of Virginia and the first to join the faculty at Duke University's History Department. Here's Professor Crystal Sanders of Penn State.
He nurtured four generations of African-American historians who went on to become professors because of his mentorship. So not only do we owe a lot to him in the sense of creating a pipeline of scholars of color, but he also helped change narratives of how we understand American history.
About his time at Duke, Gavin said, quote, "I knew that I would get stares, isolation, loneliness. Not everyone talked to me. There were a few people that did. What I recalled was certainly being alone a lot," unquote. But there would come a time when thousands would talk to him. He helped create Duke's Oral History Department, and in the early 1990s, he launched his signature project called Behind the Veil. His team conducted more than 1,300 interviews with blacks in the South who remembered the days of Jim Crow.
He was passionate about the unknown heroes, the people whose names you didn't know, the communities that where things took place that never made it to the normal or the usual stories of the civil rights movement.
That's Matthew Countryman. He was a student of Gavin's and now teaches at the University of Michigan.
That was the passion that he brought to all of us, was that determination to uncover those stories, to tell the stories accurately and evocatively, and to take seriously the lives and the work of people who normally don't get paid attention to in the history books.
Behind the Veil asked hundreds of blacks about how they defined American citizenship and whether the promises of the civil rights movement had been realized. Here's Jerrell Porty Watkins. She taught school in Albany, Georgia for 31 years, and she was 62 at the time of this interview in 1994.
It's no secret. Everybody knows that we are behind, you know. There are many reasons why we are behind, because in the first place, we didn't have the facilities, you know, way back even before they integrated, we didn't have the facilities that we needed. So as the years passed and when time came that we should have been up there where the whites are, we're just not there.
And here's Samuel B. Wells. He was born in 1916 in Leesburg, Georgia, and he was 78 when he was interviewed and fiercely proud of his service in World War II.
They sent the 25th Infantry over there. Black boys, black boys, black soldiers. Turn the tides. Right after that, they broke up the 25th. Too much power. Too much power. In World War II, we flew airplanes. We could fly through a needle's eye.
Wells also talked honestly about the racism in the 20th century South.
I remember police came out there one day, and we were coming up to the car and opening the door and talked with the person in there, you know. And the police came. He said, "Don't y'all know y'all can't beat the power structure?" That's right. He didn't say nothing about whether we were right or wrong. He just said we couldn't beat it.
These voices and hundreds of others would have been lost to time if not for Raymond Gavins. He spoke about his work on the show Talking History in 2004.
They were not just one-dimensional historical characters who were oppressed. They were also challenging power to become fairer and more democratic. Martin Luther King Jr. came out of this tradition. Mm-hmm. We don't get a king without the institutions like Morehouse and those colleges and universities and churches that were so important.
Raymond Gavins published 77 scholarly articles, chapters, and essays. He wrote 2 books, and the latest was just released in February. It's called The Cambridge Guide to African American History. His former student, Matthew Countryman, says the professor never really sought the spotlight. He just continued his work, doggedly determined, year after year.
In retrospect, as I look back, and I don't think I understood this at the time, was such a quiet soldier for a different kind of nation, a different kind of South, a new South in which the commitment to racial equality was part of everything we did. Working for a new South, for new kinds of opportunities for African Americans.
Atlanta native Raymond Gavins died May 22nd. He was 73 years old. Duke University lowered its flags to half-staff in his honor. And that's our show for today, but let's go back to our conversation on medical errors for just a moment. We wondered if you've ever been the patient when the medical staff goofed. What happened? Call us and tell us your story at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post a response on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.